Good morning, and welcome to a Council on Foreign Relations podcast, Africa in Transition. My name is John Campbell, and my guest today is Crispian Olver. Crispian is a South African and long a member of the governing African National Congress, commonly called the ANC. He has been on the front lines of the party's struggle with corruption. He is the author of a new book, How to Steal a City: The Battle for Nelson Mandela Bay. At the time of South Africa's transition to non-racial democracy in 1994, Americans paid more attention to South Africa than to any other African country. For many Americans, the struggle against apartheid was part of our own civil rights revolution. South Africa's new constitution was widely seen as the world's best from the perspective of protection of human rights. But in the years since then, South Africa has fallen off the radar scope. We may want to talk about that later. South Africa has the continent's most advanced economy and the potential to be the continent's leader. And then there is the elephant in the living room. President Trump's comments last week about African countries and Haiti that have provoked strong African condemnation. At its December convention, the ANC elected a new party leader, Cyril Ramaphosa, who defeated the incumbent president, Jacob Zuma's candidate, his ex-wife, Lamini Zuma. Corruption within the party was a major issue. Ramaphosa was one of the architects of South Africa's non-racial democracy and subsequently became a multimillionaire businessman. The ANC has been in electoral decline for some time, in part because of its association with corruption, often called state capture. It has been symbolized by the relationship between President Zuma and the Gupta brothers, who moved from India to South Africa after the end of apartheid. To start us off, Crispian, could you tell us something about your own journey as a white South African into the ANC?
Sure, John, and good morning. Thank you for having me. You know, in the 1980s, I was a medical student studying to be a doctor, and all young white male South Africans were conscripted into the Defence Force. It was a compulsory conscription. And the Defence Force at the time was being increasingly used to fight a partisan war. It had been deployed into the townships. It was being used to put down township unrest. And we started a movement, it was sort of largely led by students, called the End Conscription Campaign, which was, I suppose, a little bit like your anti-Vietnam War movement in the U.S., which really snowballed. And it snowballed to the extent that the apartheid regime banned ECC, arrested all the leaders. I spent one Christmas in detention. And that was a very politicizing and radicalizing experience. And when I went to practice as a doctor in the Eastern Cape, I rapidly got drawn into ANC underground structures. I, you know, associated with them in terms of their moral values. The battle against apartheid was raging. I mean, the end of the 80s, there was a low-intensity civil war in many parts of the country. And I got steadily pulled into the leadership. I was the deputy secretary for the ANC in the province, the first ANC executive that emerged after the unbanning. And in 94, I followed the ANC into government. I went into Mandela's office, in fact, working on the reconstruction and development program, and steadily found myself climbing the bureaucracy until under Thabo Mbeki, I was director general for environmental affairs and tourism. So the ANC really launched my career as a bureaucrat. I'd set out as a doctor, but I soon found that I was managing large, complex government departments.
When you were practicing medicine, were most of your patients in the townships?
Yeah. I was working in pediatrics initially at a large referral hospital called Cecilia Makawani. And the kids that I was treating were coming in with gastroenteritis, a whole lot of communicable diseases, diseases related to, poor sanitation, the lack of potable water, poor housing, And it was clear to me in the work that I was doing that to fix the problems I was trying to treat, I was, in a sense, I won't say wasting my time at a clinical level, but we needed to be intervening far higher up the value chain in terms of getting the housing and the land and the access to basic services sorted out. So even my own medical practice at the time was teaching me that there were political problems that had to be fixed if we were going to get on top of some basic social issues.
Could you summarize for our audience the ideals of the ANC in those days?
Yeah. So the ANC was guided, I mean, it started out, it's Africa's oldest liberation movement.
More than 100 years old
it's
now.
Over 100 years old. And it started out as a sort of black nationalist movement, which built a number of allies in the course of the struggle, including with the South African Indian Congress, with the Coloured People's Congress, with the White Congress of Democrats. And it started to move towards this sort of broad-based, rather inclusive, what was referred to as the Congress movement. All of it guided by the Freedom Charter, adopted in 1959 in a place called Kliptown in Soweto. And the Freedom Charter was a basic manifesto for a one-person, one-vote system in which the institutions of government are controlled by democratic decision-making and in which basic issues such as land and social services and access to education and access to healthcare are guaranteed. And throughout the trajectory of the ANC struggle, I mean, it's continued to espouse those values. And you could almost see the current constitution that has been adopted by the country as embedding the Freedom Charter in its words, in its text. So we now have a very progressive constitution. It guarantees this rising floor of socioeconomic rights. So it's very focused not just on basic freedom of association and movement and the right to free speech. It also focuses on development rights. It protects the right to property, but it calls for redress, and it explicitly mandates the state to drive that redress, to move resources to target people that have been disadvantaged by apartheid. So, you know, you can. There's a strong continuity in ANC policy all the way from the Freedom Charter 40, 50 years ago through to the constitution that we have today.
You are also describing an organization that essentially is non-racial.
Yeah.
And you have referred to the movement's gradual incorporation of Indians, coloreds, whites, as well as black Africans.
Yeah.
You've also described an organization in which there is, at least in theory, no official recognition of racial differences.
Right.
There's no house, as it were, for coloreds or house for whites or so forth, as there has been in other African countries during various transitions.
Yeah. I mean, non-racialism is a founding principle of the ANC. It's had a slightly, let's say, a contested relationship with that principle. And there were elements within the ANC that felt very strongly that the ANC should remain an organization of Africans, black Africans. And in fact, there were, you know, movements such as the Pan-African Congress, which split off from the ANC on this very issue. And the ANC stood its ground and insisted on non-racial principles. Although it took a while, I mean, it was only in the 70s that the ANC formally allowed whites to be represented on its National Executive Committee. And there is still a tension within the organization. So there are elements, you know, particularly with Indian and colored communities, who feel that the ANC remains biased to Africans. The official policy has been to advantage everyone that was historically disadvantaged by apartheid. And that includes, you know, coloreds, Asians, as well as black Africans. And, you know, the black economic empowerment policies of the ANC have tried to enshrine in law and in the procurement systems of the state a deliberate attempt to advantage a particular sector of society. And, you know, those policies remain very relevant. They are cause for some contention because there's increasingly, particularly under the presidency of Jacob Zuma, been a push for more, should we say, extra legal forms of advantage and empowerment. And the real, I mean, the battle lines within the ANC have been between the constitutionalists, mm-hmm. who believe in a procedural legal approach to the transfer of assets and wealth to a disenfranchised and disadvantaged black majority. On the other hand, the crowd around Jacob Zuma, who seem to feel that the pursuit of their radical economic transformation vision, which is the sort of battle cry that they've been using, a belief that that needs to be pursued through more particularistic and not necessarily legal means, and even a push to amend the constitution to allow expropriation without compensation.
A non-racial approach to political life mm-hmm. would seem to preclude tribalism.
Yeah.
And yet, for some friends of outsider friends of South Africa, such as myself, at various times, the people around President Zuma appeared to be appealing to a kind of Zulu particularism.
Oh, yes.
We're talking basically about matters of symbols, matters of rhetoric. But still, symbols and rhetoric matter.
I think that's a valid point. But bear in mind where the ANC came from. I mean, in the constitutional negotiations building up to 1994 and the first democratic election, there were a whole lot of regionally organized ethnic parties which had been sponsored by the apartheid state.
Indeed.
Including in KwaZulu-Natal, the Inkatha Freedom Party, which was a very troublesome partner in the negotiations, and they played some serious brinkmanship and at various moments attempted to scuttle the constitutional negotiations.
And associated with violence.
And yeah, extreme violence. And Jacob Zuma at the time was the ANC leader in KwaZulu-Natal who was charged with dealing with Inkatha and attempting to bring the what was a full-blown civil war in KZN, move it onto a more peaceful foundation and bring the IFP into the new South Africa. And, you know, in the current context, you know, where he is denounced for, you know, basically undermining the constitutional order, we tend to forget some of the things he did in our history. He saved the day by negotiating a peace in KZN. I'm no apologist for Jacob Zuma, but we do owe him a big debt around that. Now, at the time, they were, you know, the ANC was contrasted against the IFP was a very Zulu nationalist organization.
Yes,
and the ANC was pushing very strongly for this anti-ethnic, non-racial agenda. So it's somewhat ironic that, you know, subsequently within the ANC, JZ's been the one pushing a far more ethnic agenda. But he is a socially conservative person. He does have deep tribal roots. I think he's seen himself very much along the lines of a tribal patriarch dispensing patronage. His approach to politics is a patronage-driven approach.
Indeed.
And that's how he sees the transactions of power taking place, and that's how he maintains power. That's the system that he knows. And I think the flaws in that makeup, in his conception of what power is and what democracy is, have increasingly become apparent through the two disastrous periods of his presidency.
Which leads us to the question of how you found yourself investigating corruption associated with the ANC in Port Elizabeth and the larger region, which I believe you call Nelson Mandela Bay?
Correct. Named after a real hero of the liberation struggle and a global icon. But ironically, the most corrupt city in South Africa at a particular period in time in our
history. The most corrupt.
I would say the most
corrupt. At least of the large cities.
It was the site of one of the largest scandals, the largest corruption scandal. And this was linked to the bus rapid transit system that was built in the build-up. You know, South Africa hosted the Soccer World Cup in 2010.
Yes.
And it invested heavily in infrastructure in its cities, built big stadiums, and tried to significantly improve public transport so that people could move to and from the games. And Port Elizabeth invested in this huge BRT system known as the Integrated Public Transport System, costing billions of rands and funded through a national to local grant. By the time I got involved, which was some 5 years later, some 2.2 billion rands had already been spent on the system, but the buses were still not running.
Oh.
Which sort of is indicative of the extent of graft. I was tapped by the then Minister for Provincial and Local Government. His name was Pravin Gordhan. You've probably known him through his other role as the Minister of Finance.
Well known here in that role, and he's highly respected.
Yes, indeed. One of South Africa's greatest assets, and a man who's absolutely fearless and prepared to stand up to corruption and do whatever it takes to root it out. So he's played an extremely influential role. I had known Pravin many years earlier when I was running the local government department, and I crafted much of the legislation that currently governs local government in South Africa. And at the time, he was in Parliament. He was the chair of our portfolio committee. I think he found me a rather bolshy, argumentative director general because I was slightly intolerant of MPs' views. You know, I was young and I didn't fully understand the niceties of some of the politics. But we, you know, we produced some great legislation. We worked together on the local government white paper, and we crafted a very progressive developmental local government system, which has, you know, had some successes and some spectacular disasters. So I do take both the credit and the blame for South Africa's current local government travails. But Pravin knew me from that period.
And you were, by definition, an expert on local government.
Yes, yes. So, I mean, I knew local government very well. I knew the legislation. I'd written the legislation. And I'd been out of government for a little bit, specializing in trying to fix dysfunctional municipalities. And Pravin...
As a consultant.
As a consultant. Mm-hmm. So I'd worked for the World Bank. I'd done some work for my former department. I'd been hired by a number of cities. So I had a bit of a track record as a municipal turnaround specialist. And Pravin was looking for someone to send in to Nelson Mandela Bay. We talked a bit about the corruption earlier, but this had been bubbling on for a while. And the spur to action came in the 2014 national elections. When they totaled up the results for Nelson Mandela Bay, the ANC, which had been in power in Nelson Mandela Bay ever since the metropolitan municipality was set up, they suddenly found themselves below 50% in terms of votes. And if they projected that forward to the 2016 local government elections, they knew they were going to be out of power. So Pravin wanted to act on the corruption. Powers that be, including Jacob Zuma, I think were a little bit more worried about the electoral slide. And the big issue that was fueling the slide was people's loss of confidence in the ANC as a governing party. And, you know, the widespread view in PE was that ANC politicians were simply on the take for their own interests.
And that had electoral consequences.
And that had electoral consequences, which I suppose is a good thing for democracy. I mean, it shows you that the electorate is alert and mobile and is not going to take for granted that the ANC is a historical party of liberation.
And the importance of credible elections. I think it's significant that experts on elections judge the quality of South African elections as equivalent to those in Japan or the United States.
Right.
So elections matter.
We've had an extremely strong independent electoral commission governed by highly impartial, principled people, many judges. Johan Krichler was chair of the IEC at one stage, Brigalia Bum, you know, some really top people have been running the IEC. And it's got the confidence of all parties.
And so that drove the ANC's interest or focused its attention on problems of corruption in a particular city.
It created an alliance around cleaning up. Pravin wanted to clean up corruption anyway, but suddenly the top leadership of the ANC were prepared to do anything, including going after some of their most trusted lieutenants on the ground in PE. So they then gave Pravin a clean mandate. Go in, sort it out, do whatever has to be done.
And then he then brought you in as the expert to actually do it.
He needed a point man to go in and, you know, do the rough and tumble.
Did it work?
Yes and no. I mean, it worked on one level. Let me explain what we did. We did two things. The one was to intervene in the ANC in the region. Mm-hmm. So the ANC regional executive was disestablished. Mm-hmm. They appointed an interim task team. I was actually put onto that task team. So I was on this interim ANC regional executive. And it gave me a detailed insight into the mechanics of ANC politics in the region and the way that branch politics works in the region and how the flow of resources and patronage works within the party. And included in that, I managed to ingratiate myself with the finance committee. So I got onto the fundraising committee to try and find out exactly how party finances worked, because I was pretty sure that that was a source of a lot of the corruption. And then I was the sort of axe man in the municipality in charge of all the investigations, recommending who gets charged.
Because there's criminal behavior here.
Oh, clearly.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, there were disciplinary matters. Our first job, I suppose, was to get people out of the municipality and to get them dismissed. But there were also criminal matters, and we worked closely with a number of the security agencies, the Hawks, crime intelligence, other arms of the police, NPA, the prosecuting authority. So there was, you know, there was a wide collaboration, including with National Treasury's forensic team and audit teams. There were a number of forensic audits triggered.
But you said partial success, or success in some areas, but not others.
Yes.
What are the others?
So we succeeded in cutting off the flow of resources into the syndicates that had captured Nelson Mandela Bay, which produced an unexpected backlash. So the political players that we were going after organized a serious backlash within the ANC. We went into the 2016 elections deeply divided. Parts of the ANC actively demobilized their forces and told them not to campaign. And for the voters, you know, we were seen as a party that was equivocating about corruption. They were not convinced that the new mayor and his new mayoral committee that we'd brought in were going to continue to have the support of the ANC. And, you know, the voters voted us out of power.
Indeed, they did.
The ANC dropped from the 50%, 49% they had in 2014, to 41% 2 years later, which shows you how mobile the electorate is. I mean, this is an urban electorate. It's largely African. There's a strong colored community, but they turn against the ANC and they vote them out of power.
And voters in South Africa can be independent.
Correct.
One last issue before we conclude. Americans this past weekend, which of course commemorates Martin Luther King, the icon of the American civil rights movement. Americans this past weekend have been very much focused on the rather unfortunate characterization by President Trump of Africa and Haiti. Do you see this as having a long-term consequence for African perception of the United States?
Indeed. I mean, it's a highly unfortunate set of comments. It's produced outrage across the political divide in South Africa. So not just from the ANC, but from also all the opposition parties. Indeed. There are a whole range of other African countries that have come out extremely strongly against President Trump's statement. And the unfortunate consequence is it's, you know, persuading a whole generation of politicians that their future does not lie with the West and with the US, and they're, you know, being strengthened in, you know, turning towards the East, towards China, towards Russia, who have proven, certainly the Russians in South Africa have proven to be, you know, extremely dodgy in their practices, trying to push through a nuclear deal that the country cannot afford. So, you know, I think these kinds of comments really run counter to not just Africa's intentions and development needs, but to the US's own foreign policy objectives. I think they're rash and extremely unfortunate.
I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And what, finally, is an optimistic story? Thank you.
Thank you.